Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Standard Issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 302 of the Standard Issue pod scene. I'm Mickey Noonan. I know we don't usually start like this, but I am so excited about this week's Sunday Chops, in which I chat to Stranger Things writer Kate Treefry.
Ooh.
Because you really liked it at the theatre, yeah? The play is phenomenal. It's one of the best things I've ever seen at the theatre, and I have been lucky enough to see a lot of theatre.
Excellent.
Good.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy. I've reached some of my New Year's targets already.
Show off.
Talk us through your achievements.
Yeah, well, I decided that rather than have, like, I want to give up something or do whatever, I just thought I'd like to have a number of things that I do, and one of them was read more books that aren't for work. And I just wanted to read a book a month. So I just wanted to read 12 books that weren't for work. And I have already read 12 books that aren't for work.
Oh my God.
I am a bit agog at that because that was one of my resolutions and I'm failing miserably.
I haven't read one. Audiobooks changed my life, Jen. Genuinely changed my life. You can listen to them, you know, while you're doing your washing up, while you're incredibly tedious stuff that you're doing. Just do it with an audiobook. And I have watched less telly. I have to say, I have watched less telly. There's only so many hours in the day.
I love an audiobook, but does that count as reading a book?
I mean, as if there's anything more lazy than lying on the sofa reading a book. Lying on the sofa and having it read to you is certainly like...
I want to suggest you ingested 12 books.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, I think it counts, as in I've listened, you know, I've taken in the information. I just haven't used my eyeballs to do it. In fact, I've generally multitasked the shit out of my life and done it while doing other things.
While reaching other New Year's targets. Wowee, look at her.
Exactly that. Not doing so well with other stuff. But yeah, I just try to do stuff once a month. Go to the theatre once a month. Go to the cinema once a month.
Go on holiday once a month.
Go on holiday once a month, yeah. I've done a lot of that. Oh, by the way, can I just say, I'm reading The Women.
And it's really good. Really good. It's about a nurse in the Vietnam War.
Well, guys, if you want to hear about the highlight of my week, I'm Jen Offord. And last week, genuinely, I thought this was quite exciting. I walked into a different weather front. I don't think this has ever happened to me before. I saw the rain, like, about 5 metres down the road. It wasn't raining above me, but I could see it. And then I walked into it.
And then did your house land on a wicked witch?
No, I thought that was really... I don't think that's ever happened to me before. I was quite excited by that. But I do realise it's ultimately quite dull as well.
Once, it was snowing out the front of my house and raining out the back.
My mum says this, that she's like, don't you remember in the old house when it used to rain at the front and not at the back? And I was like, what, routinely?
How big was that house?
Not that big. It was quite tall, but it wasn't, like, particularly wide.
Coming up, I'm talking to Andy Osho about novels, Northern Ireland, and the return of Blue Lights.
Whoop, whoop.
You've watched it all, haven't you, Jen?
I have, yeah. We'll talk about it in the next Outside the Box. I chat to writer Kate Atwell and director Diane Page about Test Match, which is showing at the Orange Theatre from today, if you're listening on Wednesday. And in Jenny Off the Blocks, there are some new Invincibles in town.
And will we survive another year in an American high school? Just find out, as in Rated or Dated, we watched 2004's Mean Girls.
But first, Cher, shithousery and a drunk dog. I know that sounds like a Tory MP's party, but it's actually the Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
I can't believe you'd made me want to go to a Tory MP's party.
Bush Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph, where we are still reeling from the news that Liz Truss doesn't want to be Prime Minister again.
Oh. I mean, why would she want to be Prime Minister again? She did it for like 20 minutes and has made an absolute fortune out of it
and has been allowed to put people in positions of power, and she's got a pension. I mean,
do you not think
it seems ideal?
The question is more that, like, who the fuck does Liz Truss think she is? Suggesting it would even be a possibility. Oh, I don't want to do it. Do you think we'd have you? I think people would take to the streets.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm obsessed with her. It is the gift that just keeps giving for her.
Now, Jen, I'd like you to imagine that you're 78. I don't know how hard parenting has been this weekend, so it might be easier than I'm expecting. Okay, you're 78.
Yeah.
It's the middle of the night, and I genuinely mean the middle of the night, not like 78-year-olds middle of the night, which is like 11:30.
Which is also my middle of the night, but yeah.
You're into this mindset very well already. I mean, it's 3:15 a.m. and your phone rings.
Okay.
That put the wind up you, right?
Yeah.
Is someone ill? Has someone died? Has countdown been cancelled? No. It's somehow worth. It's a Tory MP saying it's a matter of life or death.
Oh.
He's been locked in a flat by some bad people who are demanding £5,000. What? Not even characters played by Liam Neeson get phone calls like that. Thanks for your role in that, Jen. Well done. Oh, yes. Welcome to the world of MP Mark Menzies. I feel like that should be pronounced Ming, but, you know, like Ming Campbell. But anyway, I'm going to say Menzies because I think that's how he pronounces it. With apologies, as ever, to Scotland.
Of course. Goes without saying.
I say welcome. To be clear, that's just to us plebs. The Tory party has known about his behaviour for some time. At the weekend, the MP for Fylde said he had resigned from the Conservative Party and would not stand for re-election after the Times revealed a series of frankly insane claims, of which calling a former campaign manager at 3:15 a.m. is merely the tip of a very mucky iceberg. The sum, which apparently rose to £6,500, was eventually paid by his office manager with her own money, although she was then reimbursed using campaign funds raised from donors. So that's okay then.
I think that's the same thing, isn't it?
I'm guessing even people giving money to the Tories don't imagine it's going so directly to something so nefarious. It was not, according to the Times expose, the first time donated money had been used by Menzies for his personal use. Some £14,000, it is alleged, given by donors for use on Tory campaign activities, had previously been transferred to Menzies' personal bank account and used for his private medical expenses. He is also accused of borrowing and not returning campaign funds in 2020. In January, a former campaign manager reported what had happened to the Conservative chief whip, telling him that Menzies had pressurised staff into handing over their own savings for his personal use.
Huh?
Their own savings. An investigation was opened and transferred from the whip's office to Conservative campaign headquarters. This isn't the first scandal Menzies has been involved with. In 2014, a Brazilian sex worker told the Sunday Mirror that the MP had paid him for sex and asked him to buy an illegal drug. And in 2017, Menzies was interviewed by police after it was claimed he'd got an acquaintance's dog drunk and, when challenged, started a fight with that friend. I mean, this is next-level political idiocy, Jeremy Thorpe-level political idiocy. Menzies called these allegations, quote, false and malicious, and a source close to the MP said the dog had drunk alcohol that had been placed on the grass while the friend fell asleep. Sure. There have also been claims that last year, at a Last Night of the Proms concert in his constituency, Menzies turned up drunk and got into a row with other patrons. One attendee said the MP, quote, started kicking the chairs and poking the people on the front row. A source close to the MP, maybe the same one that made the dog excuse, who knows, acknowledged that Menzies had had too much to drink and may have accidentally poked people when waving a flag. Again, sure. Now, I know that people might be thinking, why am I talking about this when there is so much actual politics going on at the moment? To which I'd say, there's not. Most of the hot air being talked at the moment is never going to happen. We're in the last days of Rome in terms of this Tory government. They're just desperate to try and salvage some votes and cling on to some power.
So now is exactly the time to ignore what they say and look at what they do. Because if this guy is anything to go by, what they do is frankly batshit. Yeah.
Why are you out there getting dogs drunk? Like, what's that for?
I don't know. Shits and giggles. I don't know.
Oh, man.
Poor doggy.
Hannah, look. Look over there. What's that? Is it a drunk dog?
Is it a pissed up dog? It just stumbled across a gin and tonic that was just on the grass.
Great. Well, now you're distracted by that drunk dog. I'm going to quietly distribute some of your money to my mates and hope you don't notice. Does that sound kind of familiar? I mean, not the drunk dog. Obviously, we wrote these bits separately. And they've just fitted together so beautifully. I am, of course, talking about the so-called culture wars. It's fair to say that tensions are being stoked all over the shop at the moment. One presumes in a bid to distract us from what's really going on, like NHS waiting lists, for example, or just a total absence of actual policies on anything. Shrugs.
It's literally guffing hot air into our faces.
But will it work? Not according to research by think tank More in Common, commissioned by campaign group 38 Degrees. In a survey of 2,000 voters, participants were shown four constituency-focused political messages by both the Labour Party and the Tories, including some neutral as well as some focused more on the culture wars. The results showed that participants looked more favourably on neutral campaigns and were less likely to vote for parties on the basis of those stoking tensions. This went both ways. Apparently, with a Tory message that the woke mob is taking over, causing a 10% loss in Tory voters' willingness to back Sunak. Meanwhile, Labour's assertion that we need to fight back against this racist government did go down quite well within its own ranks, but showed a 4% of increase in voters who were unlikely to back Starmer. Starmer, of course, will need to appeal to voters outside of his own ranks in order to win the election. It's almost as if the electorate is not actually as daft as politicians seem to believe.
This has long been the case that, I know this because I worked for a local newspaper for years, people care a lot more about when their bins are going to be collected and how many potholes there are in their street and dog shit than they do about whether we should defund the BBC. Some people care about defunding the BBC or about woke nonsense. But at the end of the day, they tend to vote with their pockets. Because people will always vote for what affects them personally, or almost always.
But they should. You're supposed to vote for your local MP. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to vote for someone who is interested in your local area and making it better. So, you know.
And making the dogs more pissed.
Exactly. Getting the dogs drunk. So at this point, I will say, there is an election on the 2nd of May. If you're in London, you get to vote for a new mayor or the same mayor, if you're sensible. There will be local elections and it's too late to register to vote. So I hope you're already registered, but it's maybe not too late to get voter ID. Get it anyway. It will be helpful at some point within the next year when we have a general election.
Jen, you have mentioned this so much. I will be amazed if any of our listeners are not registered to vote and don't already have their voter ID.
It's a hill I'm prepared to die on, Hannah.
It's a good service you've done the world there. As a reward, would you like some good news?
Very much, yes, please.
Well, I have some. And it's particularly good news for Cher fans.
Fantastic.
Now, if this was Mickey, Mickey would do a blast or something here, I believe, or, you know, just like Jesse James or something. Can I hand that over to you, Jen?
Do you believe in love after love?
Great, thank you. Cher has finally, after nearly 60 years in the business, been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. If you're thinking that she hasn't been inducted before, that's because she's not actually rock and roll. Just know that's actually not a bar to entry. Artists of all genres can be added to the US institution 25 years after their first recording. So why has Cher been ignored up until now? Something she previously stated was a bit rude.
I agree.
Well, I hate to say that it's because she's a woman, so let's hear Courtney Love say that instead. She wrote in The Guardian last year, "The Rock Hall's canon-making doesn't just reek of sexist gatekeeping, but also purposeful ignorance and hostility.
If so few women are being inducted into the Rock Hall, then the nominating committee is broken. If so few black artists, so few women of colour are being inducted, then the voting process needs to be overhauled.
And she's not wrong. Last year it was calculated that fewer than 10% of inductees have been women since the awards began in 1986. A record number of inductees this year also include Mary J. Blige and A Tribe Called Quest, which would suggest that things may be about to change. More news next year, I suppose.
And indeed, more news next time.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week.
It's that time of the week when we ask, are you an expert in your field? A professor in political theory? Okay, cool. Unzips flies all the same. Yuck, yuck, and thrice over yuck. I am, of course, talking about that piece by The Spectator's Checks Notes sketch writer and theatre critic, Lloyd Evans, in which he volunteers the information that he paid for sex after becoming aroused by a lecture about Kant.
It's hot stuff.
We've all done it. But it wasn't transcendental idealism that got Evans all hot under the collar. It was historian Professor Leia Upi, who very much floated his boat as he voluntarily wrote about last week. He opens the article thus. Like being chained to a lunatic, that's how a man feels in relation to his libido. Continuing to describe Upi's appearance, her blonde hair spilling over her shoulders absorbed far more of my attention than her political reflections, and I was desperate to speak to her afterwards, but I had no way to orchestrate a meeting. I'm really not surprised. You creepy fuck.
Presumably just walking towards her with a massive erection didn't occur to him, right?
Man. He goes on to, I'm going to say it again, voluntarily describe his encounter with a Chinese sex worker which followed the lecture. There is so much that's wrong with this, I really don't know where to start. Maybe with the way he reduces an academic, a professor no less, to a sex object? Maybe the inherent abuse of power that comes with paying someone for sex. Maybe the way he absolves himself of all responsibility by blaming it on his winky.
Yeah.
It is good to see. The overwhelming response to this piece has been of enormous distaste. But we are living in very strange and very sexist times when shit like this is actually being commissioned. Grim.
Yeah, I talked to Helen Lewis online about this and also to Yosra in person about this last week, because it also contains like a number of like massive inaccuracies that I'm amazed weren't picked up.
Yeah.
For example, it says, it either says it was at Darwin when it was Downing or the other way around.
It says it's Downey when it's Darwin, yeah.
He also, the word to is spelled incorrectly at one point, which any sub would pick up, surely, to Christ. But he also rather hilariously describes Cambridge train station as being in the rougher end of town. I mean, it's not. And if people are wondering where is the rougher end of town in Cambridge, it's where I live.
Do you think he meant Cambridge North, Hannah? Rather than
No, the thing about Cambridge North, Jen, is that he said it's where, like, the outcasts hang out. There's literally not a living soul at Cambridge
North. No one knows it exists, do they?
He can't possibly have been referring to it. So he was talking about Cambridge Main Station, which is where the Microsoft Research Lab is and where there are million-pound flats and where Yosra pointed out to me there is a Claire's Bakery. You know, this is the rougher end of town. It's insane. It's an insanely written piece.
Yeah, also, like, what... At what point in your career as a theatre critic do you go, oh, I'm a bit bored of Tennessee Williams, think I'm going to tell you about paying someone for sex instead?
Yeah.
Okay, Lloyd. Again, whatever floats your boat. What a fucking weird thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing else to say to it, is there? And that's two with just the one out.
All right, Mickey here with an advert for BetterHelp Therapy Online. You all right? Such a small question and sometimes such a big question too, eh? Now, regular listeners will know I am no stranger to depression. And while over time and with the help of some decent counselling and brilliant friends and family, I've established a toolkit to help, when the constantly dripping tap of life gets a bit too much. That does not mean I am a stress-free human rainbow skipping through meadows. I mean, who is? We all carry around different stresses, big and small, and sometimes we can deal, and sometimes it's much harder to cope. Life, innit? Right now, I have a teenage puppy to deal with, and although I love her very, very much, she can be a lot. There, said it. And as quick a fix as it seemed to say, I'm fine, and push it all down into the big inside box and put that lid on. For me, that hasn't been a great long-term solution, in that if I don't get it off my chest, it will at some point come bubbling up, and it's never been one to pick its moments in a good way. I find talking means I can avoid it exploding out of me like a messy emotional volcano all over my nana's carpet. Also, during my various times in talk therapy, I discovered that saying something out loud or writing it down can make it seem much more manageable than allowing it to swirl around and grow ever bigger in my head. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. I've found knowing how to reach out is sometimes the toughest bit, but BetterHelp is entirely online. Boom. Which means it couldn't be easier. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a registered therapist, then work your sessions around your schedule. With more than 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. Standard Issue listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/standard. That's betterhelp.com/standard. Hello, Hannah here. I am absolutely delighted to say welcome to Standard Issue, Andy Oshow.
Thank you so much.
I was trying to think about the last time that I spoke to you, which was back when we were both doing comedy.
Yeah.
Couldn't remember. And then I started reading your book, Tough Crowd. And then once I was in that mindset, thinking about you and comedy, because it's not you, but it's kind of you, I suppose.
Right. Wink, wink, wink.
It was at a gig that we did in Cambridge. I had given up smoking and then gone back to smoking, and you had been exceptionally disappointed in me that I'd gone back to smoking.
Oh, no. No, you're righteous, Andy. Yay.
Now I feel like you're my mum or my teacher or something, and I can say to you, I have actually given up smoking
I'm delighted. It's not easy, though. And I've realised since then that giving up anything or starting something or creating a new habit is a constant stream of starting agains, isn't it? It's not like a one-time thing, which is why I think people have to remember that was when they're trying something like giving up smoking or losing weight or whatever it is. It's just like you just keep beginning again, and one time it will be 4 days, and the next time it will be, I remember giving up for a morning.
Yeah.
I was like, I can't do it. And then smoking again by the afternoon. So it's constant, like trying and trying again, isn't it?
Yeah. Do you miss comedy? Because you're not doing it anymore.
I'm not. No. I don't really. I mean, there's certain aspects of it where, you know, you can get a bit nostalgic. But to be honest with you, there are so many things about it that I didn't feel, let's put it like this, like weren't working for me as such. So the things that I would gain by doing it again, I feel like I'd be sad about the things that I was losing, or like my evenings, you know.
Oh, absolutely. That was at a gig last week. And while I'm in that moment, when I'm in the crowd and the crowd is loving it, and then I think, oh my God, this used to happen for me. I love this. I miss this. But then I went to see a friend of mine in Devon, and I got stuck in the worst traffic on the way home. And I was like 7 hours on the M6. Oof. And I thought, I remember now why I hate it.
Yes.
I remember now what the worst thing about comedy was.
That's it. I mean, you are literally, your day can be, your work day can be 8 hours, 9 hours or whatever with all the driving for 20 minutes on stage sometimes, you know, if you're doing circuit gigs. And, you know, if it's your own show, then that's kind of, you know, seeing a crowd that's there for you, that can really pay dividends. But still, oof, it's a big undertaking.
So we're here to talk about Blue Lights series 2. Now, I wasn't sure that Sandra was going to be back this series because of the events that happened at the end of the last series. I am delighted to see her back. Were you sure she was coming back?
Well, only because, you know, Declan Lorne and Adam Patson, who wrote Blue Lights, they talked about what next for Sandra, I think, either before we'd finished or, you know, shortly after. Once we knew there was going to be a second season, I think they decided that she was going to be part of it. But also, I think we all felt like it was more interesting for her to stay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even though Jerry was the reason she was in Belfast in the first place, you know, that the change in circumstances shouldn't necessarily mean that she would go back, you know, because a home is about where you feel at home, not necessarily where your physical stuff is, you know what I mean? Having Sandra stay, I felt like was a really, really lovely choice for her.
She's a different person. I know this because I know widows, and I know that they say the same thing to me, which is I might seem like the same person, but I'm actually a different person.
Yeah,
now this has happened to me. How did you tackle that?
Well, again, as always, it sounds trite, but it is in the writing. So, you know, from that, I can extrapolate where she's at. And basically, I think Sandra is the kind of person who, like, without saying too much for people that haven't seen season one, like what she did in that last episode after she would have just collapsed into a pool. But then after that, she would have just put on a veneer and just got through it. One of the changes that they made for Sandra was that she's no longer in the custody suite. So, you know, that meant when she was in the custody suite, it was a lot of time behind a desk. It's a different type of responsibility. Now she's a response officer. And I think for her, that is a really useful distraction to help her keep that sort of exterior Sandra together, you know?
You do a bit of running in the bit that I saw. And I was like, come on, Andy, with your fitness. I'm really impressed.
Yeah, we had a morning of running. That was, I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I'm up for all of that. And the more that I see that sort of stuff in the script, the more that will make me take my own fitness seriously. Because you don't want to embarrass yourself. Right, Sandra's going to sprint down this alleyway. And I'll be like, is she going to sprint down? Or is she going to canter? Is it going to be more like a fast walk? You know, you don't want to have to do that. So, yeah, I love it. Just the more different physical stuff that we get to do, the more I find it interesting.
I've watched 4 episodes of the series, and I was so delighted to see that the quality has absolutely not diminished at all.
Oh,
I think it's still really good. Because not just Jerry's gone, because Jerry was the life and soul of it. Richard Dormer has gone. He's such a great actor.
Yeah.
I was a little bit like, can I cope with the loss of Jerry?
I mean, overwhelmingly, like Declan and Adam will say, they'll be doing a talk and then, you know, they'll open it up for Q&As. And invariably, at least one person will be like, love Blue Light, think it's great. But why did you kill, you know?
Yeah.
So, he was a beloved character, but they've brought other characters to the fore, brought in new characters as well. So there's a lot of richness still in the show in terms of the characters. And actually, because it's not a procedural, that's the most important thing in the show, is like who these things are happening to rather than what.
Now, you and I are around the same age, so I'm assuming that you remember the sort of same level of things I remember about what was going on during the Troubles in Northern Ireland. Did you have to do a bit more reading? Did you feel like you understood the issues that there were over there?
I had like surface level understanding. I think it's a surface level understanding that you get when you're hearing this news basically as a teenager. A lot of it happened when, you know, we were in our teens. And so you're only taking, unless you're a politically active teenager, and some people around me were, but I just wasn't, you know, I was into Bros. So getting the role definitely meant having to do a deep dive. Also, because obviously what you see in the news is just surface level anyways, it's the headlines. Unless you're drilling down into watching current affairs shows, people in the mainland wouldn't have really understood the nuance of it. And so that's what I had to get my head around, because I have to think, what would my character know? So she'd know what she'd seen, same as me. We're about the same age, I would say. She's maybe a little bit older than me, but like she would have seen the news. But she's living with somebody who would have given her a first-hand account of what it was really like. So she would need to know all that as well.
Yeah. I spoke to Gemma Whelan last year, maybe, about The Tower. And we were talking about how it's an interesting time for cop dramas on TV because we feel slightly differently about police officers than perhaps we have in the past. Certainly, the idea that the policeman is always the hero of the story is no longer the case. So, yeah, I think Blue Lights handles that fine line between the fact of the police as an institution and then individual officers, who many of whom are just trying to do their best every day.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, certainly I manage how I talk about it on socials and stuff because, you know, at the end of the day, there's a lot of people that don't have a lot of love for the police, and rightly so sometimes because of, you know, certain behaviours and things that have been done and things that they've covered up and things like that. But it is a drama. And like you say, it's trying to take on that grey area as well. And also, without being partisan, just show what the experience is like on an individual level. This is what's happening to these people. This is why they're thinking what they're thinking. But there's a person behind all those decisions. There's a person behind that uniform, you know?
I take it you spent quite a lot of the last year in Belfast then.
Yeah, so it's quite a long filming period. I think, when did we go out there? So I remember we finished in December. Maybe we started in like August or something like that. There was a lot to do, you know? It's a bigger, bolder season. So got pyrotechnics. You know, it takes a minute to sort all that stuff out. But it's a lot of back and forth. So I didn't get as much time once again. Like the first time was due to COVID, but this time due to the nature of schedules, I didn't get a huge amount of time to get to know the city. But maybe one day I'll be there for a stint and I'll be able to, like, you know, just check out some cool bars and stuff.
In all sorts of jobs that my friends had when they got to go abroad, and I'd always be like, oh man, you're going to Vienna. And they're like, I'm going to an industrial estate for 16 hours and then I'm coming home. That is not going to Vienna. But if you don't have a job where you get to travel, you always feel a bit jealous of other people who do.
It does seem very glam. I worked for Disney for a little while and we launched Disney channels around Europe. So that literally meant like going out there once a week for however long, training up the staff and stuff like that. So we were going to Milan and Munich and Madrid, all M cities for some reason. And it did seem like on the surface, it did seem pretty glam and sort of a cool, but it wasn't. It's just you're just constantly on flights and just like waking up at the crack of dawn and, like you say, being in the corner of an industrial estate, teaching people how to schedule Mickey Mouse cartoons.
Yesterday, I spoke to Tanya Franks. I want to ask you the same question that I asked her, which is, tell me about working with Michaela Cole, because you were in I May Destroy You.
Yeah. So where did Tanya work with Michaela? What show was that?
Chewing Gum.
Ah, of course. Right. Okay. So, yeah, great. I mean, she was showrunner. No, was she co-director and showrunner on I May Destroy You? And what was really great about it was that it showed that more diversity behind the camera is possible than people make out. Oh, we don't know where we're going to find a black makeup artist. And we don't know how to find a good wardrobe person. Well, they did it. So
yeah,
maybe you're not looking in the right places, you know. That was really great. And also, she's very generous scene partner. And yeah, it was great. It was a good experience. I think I only did like 1 or 2 days, so I didn't really get to know her massively. But I really appreciated the time with her. So yeah, had a good time.
It was interesting because it was filmed differently, wasn't it? It was like the half hour episode. So
yeah,
which was quite a different move for drama. But I think it kind of meant that she could focus on lots of things individually rather than try and get a lot of issues covered in the same episode, which I think she did really well.
I think as well, what was interesting was I, reading it, I'm going to be honest, I couldn't see it on the page. I was like, not sure about this as I was reading it. But she clearly had a vision of what she wanted and was able to execute on it as well, because what was on screen was so much more than what was on the page. And that doesn't always happen. Like, you can read something, a technically great script, but on screen it doesn't deliver any more than that. Whereas with hers, because she wasn't necessarily adhering to quote unquote the rules, when she got to the point of realizing it, she was able to bring all the stuff maybe that was in her head that she hadn't put on the page onto the screen. And so it was just like, I was just blown away by it. And it made it more of a happening almost rather than just a traditional straight series that you would expect. I think that's why it landed in the way that it did with people.
So I mentioned Tough Crowd, which I am currently reading. It's your second book. Asking for a Friend was your first book.
Yeah.
Was writing a book a lifelong ambition for you, or was it something that you thought, I wonder if I could do that, and then discovered that you could?
Gosh, that's a good question. You know, when I was a kid, I always wanted to write. And I used to write a lot in class. Like, English was probably my favourite lesson. But I didn't really know how to execute on actually writing a book. So it was sort of there as an ambition, but one that I never actually did anything about outside of school. Or outside of being told to at school, you know. My agent had a conversation with my now publishers, HQ Stories at HarperCollins. And so I got this book deal. And then I was like, oh, right.
I got to it.
Now I have to write a book. You know, first book deal was one book. And then I got another deal during lockdown. So I was like, I need to work. You know, what can I be doing during this time? So I got another book deal for 2 books. So I owed them 3 in the end. It's like, didn't you learn from writing the first one, like how difficult you found it? So it was an ambition, but it wasn't one that, until the press of having a contract that you have to fulfill came, that's when I really sort of went for it, obviously.
A lot of problem with finishing books is finishing books. So actually having a deadline.
Yeah. I've got a podcast about creativity, but I think about this a lot. And one of the challenges I think people have is that they're trying to do too many different processes at the same time when they're writing the book. So they're trying to, you know, splurge out a first draft, but they're also judging it as well, which is more second, third draft activity. And they're trying to edit as well as they go, maybe. So again, that's a later draft activity. And so all this doubt is crashing around in the part of the process that really should be about just getting the thing done. And I say this from bitter experience, you know, because I procrastinated and got caught up in, you know, trying to do too much in one go with the first book. And so with the second, it was this third one that I'm writing now was an absolute joy to write the first draft, relatively speaking, because I didn't even stop. I didn't look back once, you know, I just kept writing and writing and writing. And so it was done in a relatively short amount of time. So I say to anybody who has got a book idea or started something but doesn't know how to finish it, just get something down, because it's easier to edit. You can't edit a blank page, basically. But once it's done, then now you've got somewhere to go with it. Now you've got something to work with. A three-book obligation. So this is me fulfilling on that last one. But yeah, I'm just taking everything that I've learned in terms of technique and approach and stuff. I've just taken everything that I've learned from the first two and applied it to this. And I've sort of taken a bit of a different direction as well, because the first two, as you're discovering, are more sort of in the rom-com kind of space. But this one, my editor called it the other day, she called it, it's kind of like a crime caper social satire. And I was like, nice. Oh, yeah, I want to see that banner in the book section.
Absolutely.
It'll just be one book, just me. But yeah.
Did you know that's what you were writing?
I wanted to have a different direction, and I knew that I wanted my books to also, or at least this one, to say a little bit more about the state of the world as well. So it sort of gravitates around the housing market. And I'll say more closer to the time when it's coming out.
Problem.
But yeah, but it's just, I felt like I wanted to just weave in a little bit of social politics while keeping the comedy as well, you know.
I wanted to ask you about your hair, Andy, because you have gone grey, which is pretty rare in your industry, and I like it. I mean, I like it because it looks great on you, but I like it that you are not afraid to be aging in the normal manner.
I mean, it took a little bit of, like, you know, conversations with myself to get to that point. It wasn't like, oh look, here I am totally comfortable with no longer being 35, you know. But at the end of the day, it's like it just seems so ridiculous that we try and fight it. The language in around us is still so, like, against a process that we literally are incapable of stopping. Even whatever you do to your face, if you have whatever surgery, you are still biologically aging, even if your face remains frozen at, like, you know, 40 or whatever. So I just felt like the fight was becoming exhausting. I was having to dye my hair, like, because it was so gray, I was having to dye it like every 2 weeks, really, to hide the little halo of grey that you get around the front. And I was like, this is ridiculous. And even my mum said to me, yeah, but what about work? What's going to happen if you... I was like, well, maybe I'll get different jobs, you know, like, because I have a different look. So I had to do it just for my own... I wasn't really thinking about work. I was really thinking about my own sort of sense of self-worth and my own sort of happiness, really. It's just like, I just don't want to be on this carousel anymore. Excuse me, stop it. I want to get off.
I agree. I didn't even know I wanted to do it until lockdown. And then lockdown gave me the opportunity that no one was going to see me, because actually the halo's the worst part.
Yes.
When it gets to here and it's really obvious you're just growing your grey out, it looks okay. I think
it's true.
But I've encountered so many women that went grey in lockdown that really grasped hold of it and were just know what, don't care. And I think it's a positive thing, because I wouldn't criticise. The reason I started dyeing my hair is because I went grey so young that it was really shocking to be as grey as I was at 28 or something. You know, nobody wants to be grey at 28. But then you get, like you say, you get stuck on this carousel. I can remember
was in Ireland, that's about, I don't know, 2008, and I'd managed to fall over and I was covered in mud. And I went into, got into this lift in this hotel and I was absolutely, my coat was caked in mud.
No.
I was caked in mud. And there was a mirror in the back of the lift and I looked and I thought, oh, my roots need doing. And I thought, how are you okay with all of this looking like, you know, looking like you've been rolling around in a field,
brilliant,
but that little 2 millimetres of grey is something you're obsessed by.
People have such interest in such, it doesn't grow necessarily as one shade of grey. You've got so many different like layers in there and it's all natural, all different colours and gorgeous.
I have one last question for you, Andy. Now, I know from your comedy and I know from your novel that who your parents are not your parents.
No,
you
know? That's right, yeah.
Your actual parents must be terribly proud of you, right?
So my dad isn't in my life. I think he is probably proud if he's heard stories. But my mum is, yeah, for sure. It's funny because she just wrote her autobiography. So we're just we're just on the sort of publicity trail for that. And so she's talking about that a lot. And people are asking her, like, where do you think you get the inspiration from? And then they're asking me, like, why do you think you became a writer? And it's just like, it's definitely because of this lady. Because she had all this, like, creativity in her. But because of circumstances of life, she didn't have the room to express it.
What's your mum's book called?
The Jagged Path. Been like really well received. She was on Woman's Hour and Premier had her on and had a chat with her about it. So it's her life story and it's really her attempt to share the hardships she's been through in the hope that other people will find resilience through her story. So that's been her sort of driving.
That's the best reason to write a book.
Yeah. So, and it's a really beautiful story. I mean, it's kind of odd me saying that because I was editing it, but also it's like, Mum, is that exactly how that happened? That's a bunch of like, but also just learning so much about her in the process as well. So yeah, it's been lovely to walk that walk with her.
Andy, this has been an absolute pleasure.
No worries. Lovely to talk to you, Hannah.
I'm joined by Kate Atwell, writer of and Diane Page, director of the new play Test Match, which is making its UK premiere at the Orange Tree Theatre, Richmond from April 24th. Hi, guys.
Hello. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for joining me today. I wondered if you could start off, Kate, if you could tell us what the play is about.
The play is about it starts off as a rained out cricket match. It's a match between India and England. And the players are kind of waiting to find out what the call is that's going to be made on whether or not they're going to be able to keep playing. And so we start just sort of in that moment of limbo, and then the play kind of catapults back in time to colonial India and looks at a fictional, but based in reality, kind of like a farcical, pastiche kind of situation there with the East India Company and various different families and family members coming and going. Yeah, but really overall, you know, through those two lenses, it's less maybe a narrative play. It's like an accumulative experience to look at ways in which our sort of collective histories and pasts have kind of felt impact in our present lives.
What drew you to the subject matter, first of all? And why did you choose cricket as a sort of medium to explore that?
I think very, very often with my plays, what I find is quite often a sort of starting point is more of a visual image, something that I think could be visually exciting to see on stage. And I had gone back home to South Africa where I grew up. I was living in New York at the time and you know, I was up late, kind of jet lagged, and there was some women's T20 cricket, you know, on TV. And it just really struck me. I was like, I love the way these women look. I love how fierce this kit is. You know, it's very combative almost. It's very gladiatorial. And there just felt like something really exciting and dynamic about it. And the nature of the way in which cricket has sort of disseminated around the globe has been through the kind of colonial project. And it's still really England and former colonies who primarily play cricket, you know, like it's not as popular in Europe, America doesn't play it, you know. So I thought that was really interesting as a kind of then a way to to look at some of that colonial history. And I suppose at the time I was living in New York, and yeah, the sort of genesis of this play was quite a while ago, but you know, it was around the time that Black Lives Matter was really starting to take hold as a movement. And I felt that being in America, this real, you know, there was such a sort of resistance from a lot, I would say, of white America to kind of acknowledge or believe in any way that their history, obviously they're different in terms of slavery, but that that history might actually still have a really powerful impact on the kind of social structures and power dynamics of the present world. And I suppose I felt similarly in England, that the sort of realities of empire are not something that we kind of address or talk about very much. And so again, I think just like the nature of who plays the sport of cricket felt like an interesting avenue, you know, to go down to kind of talk about those things kind of from a really sort of maybe obscure angle that doesn't feel so direct or on the nose perhaps.
I think sport is quite an interesting way to explore history and sort of, I don't know, international relations, for want of a better way of putting it. There's like that famous match in the 1990 World Cup between the Netherlands and a very recently unified Germany, where Frank Rijkaard spits in Rudi Völler's hair. You know, that you do see these tensions come out. What do you think about that? Do you think sport is a good way to sort of explore these themes?
Yeah, I think as well, it's because I was just thinking, as Kate was talking, it kind of feels like a legal way to battle. I think that particularly like with international sport, regardless of what medium, there's something, isn't there, about something we talk a lot about in rehearsals, about like carrying the weight of history and baggage with you. So particularly in what you just referenced as well. And even like the fact of like, it does feel like an arena, like the spectators. So it does feel like this kind of not legal way to battle. That's not really what I want to say, but kind of that way.
Yeah, permissible way for countries to fight each other.
Yeah.
With lots of money involved.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's interesting that you said that about this sort of way to battle kind of thing. I wonder, Diane, from a staging perspective, the cast, it's not a huge cast, is it, by any stretch of the imagination? So how do you give the impression of full cricket teams within those constraints of the stage and the, you know, number of cast members that you have involved in the production?
Yeah, I think, like, because Kate's writing is so clever, it feels to me, because of the way it's written, that I don't think watching it that you ever think that about the other team members, because it's so focused on the three members from each side. But also then I think, and we don't know it when we start, but when we go into the second half of the play, I feel like that makes sense. And occasionally they're referenced, and even like the design, it almost feels claustrophobic, and the conversation never stops. It is like a piece of music that I feel like you're very much focused on them and their story as opposed to the others. And in my head as well, when they've been rained off, they just all happen to have run off together, and they're just in this kind of holding place. But what I think is interesting is that there is something about the other team that makes that team stay. Like, they want to be in that space and don't want to be in that space.
Sport in general is seen as more of a sort of masculine domain. So why did you want to use women rather than men to frame this?
I feel there's sort of an undercurrent, not the sort of sub-theme, I suppose, to the play, you know, that is, it's questioning and interrogating those kind of colonial desires to exploit. And I think it's interesting to look at the kind of intersection between that desire to exploit and take over control land and the desire to take over control women's bodies, you know. And I think that feels like that's definitely something that, yeah, by the end of the play, you're kind of starting to bubble to the surface, the way that all of those things kind of connect.
And
there's a lot of talking in the play just about the fact that they are female players and the differences that they face and the particular challenges that has brought up. And there's something, I suppose, you know, in the second part, the women play men. And I still think there's something like slightly subversive about that, you know, and just in terms of theatre, you know, the roots of theatre are so sort of embedded in the notion of that men played women all the time. Yeah. Again, I think there's a lot of just little subversions about what it's doing that, yeah, just felt really right for it to focus on women and women's bodies and women's sports.
I love the fact that just talking about women in sport and all those connections that Kate spoke about, but also just, I think, having six women on stage, six like amazing actors, feels to me like such a powerful statement. That's what I'm really excited about.
It's interesting you mention that, because I'm just thinking about a news story over the past week about, I think it's the Jamie Lloyd Theatre Company and the absolutely ridiculous furore about deciding to cast a black actress as Juliet.
No, things like this blow my mind because, guys, newsflash, it's not real. It's fictional.
Yes.
You know, like, there are people on stage, you buy your ticket. And, of course, like, I think most people know that, maybe not the people commenting on that thing, most people but the thing for me is, it's what kind of universal truths can we learn? And it should be theatrical, because it's about something bigger than us, you know, it's about us and it's about our world. But that's the important thing, it's about the things that are underneath and about the bigger things, and being able, like Kate was saying, to draw those connections. So what all we're doing is having a conversation with the audience. We're not trying to pretend that it's real.
But it's exactly the same kind of fragility that kind of underlines both, isn't it? Like the people who would have a problem with women playing cricket. I bet the Venn diagram is pretty clear, basically.
There's a overlap, totally. And they will almost certainly have a problem with this play. But I hope they can't. No, it's so interesting, isn't it? You know, I suppose having written this play, I suppose the play feels less about overt racism in the present.
Yeah.
So much as the kind of structural racism of empire and of, the kind of project of empire, and the fact of that being not addressed or being brushed aside or frankly painted in like nothing but a positive light.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, you know, sometimes I find myself going like, you know, do we need this play? Like, it's such a wonderful room and, you know, the cast are so close and it's such a warm, lovely environment, and you think like, is this necessary? Like, do we need to call attention to these questions? And then exactly that, like the Romeo and Juliet casting happens and out comes all of this racism, or anything to do with Meghan Markle happens, out comes all this racism, out comes all this white fragility, you know. So it is definitely still something that is unfortunately not fully addressed and not fully kind of accounted for.
And I think as well, like, I've had a similar thing where I directed Julius Caesar and the level of racism online was pretty wild. But as well, like, I just on that, I think that some people have an attachment to Shakespeare that I think is directly linked to ideas of British greatness and like best in the world. And that's why people become activated and animated about it, even if they probably don't go to the theatre. But certainly from us, like, and it's true what Kate said, like, I did history GCSE and I definitely learned about slavery or the transatlantic slave trade and even like British colonial rule in India through a very specific lens. Tell you what I did learn though, that, you know, we spent a lot of time talking about when Britain abolished slavery. That's what we spent a lot
of time. Of course, because we're heroes.
Exactly. And like the play touches on those elements, and I think that is the reason why it's needed now as well, because it does, I think, just start that conversation, or just a little reminder that that stuff is, you know, I keep saying, like, it's kind of in our DNA and, like, in the show, and it is, even in something like a game of cricket.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
How involved are you in the rehearsal process, Kate? Is that usually what would happen with a writer and a director?
I think it really depends, sort of show to show, I would say. Like, this play has been on before, but it was done in America. And so I do feel, you know, there's been a number of little bits of redoing and working and tweaking things to bring it in line with a British audience, I suppose. And in some ways, the particularities of the space to an extent as well. But yeah, for me, it's the UK premiere. So I do feel like quite committed to it in that way. But yeah, it really depends. I think mostly if it is a new play, there's always little changes and little discoveries and things you find in rehearsal to just shape and work and tweak. And you know, that's a really nice part of my job, is just not sitting staring at the computer by myself.
Did you use cricket as well in America? How did that go down? Because they're not known for their love of cricket, are they? Did they get it?
They definitely got it. I mean, you know, there were a number of different theatres sort of workshop this play. And I think American audiences, you know, sort of related to what we were saying earlier, I think that conversation around past and present feels very resonant and very current in America. I think in a sort of perhaps a Brechtian way, there's something maybe useful for them about it feeling like not directly speaking about their history, but those connections can be made. And, you know, there's definitely like a resonance. Yeah, it was funny. I mean, I think there's some of the cricket stuff that definitely maybe is more funny or reads as more goofy and sort of quaintly British that, yeah, American audiences found particularly funny. But actually, like, it was also quite interesting because we did it in San Francisco and there's a really big South Asian community in the Bay Area and a lot of people play cricket. And so we actually did have quite a lot of keen cricket audiences coming, which was kind of cool.
So I just wanted to ask you, Diane, because this is your third time directing at the Orange Tree, isn't it? Is that just sort of where the work has happened to be, or do you have like a particular connection to the theatre? Or like, what is it that keeps bringing you back to the Orange Tree?
Imagine I was like, it's the only place that allowed for me.
That's not what I was getting at. Sorry, just to be clear.
No, I'm joking. Well, the first show I directed by myself, I directed here. There's a director's award called the JMK, and I won that. Then you get a chance to like mount the show, and it's like a whole competition, and it's done here. So I did that. That was the first thing I directed by myself. I directed one thing previously at the Lyric. I co-directed with their artistic director. And then Paul, who was the artistic director here before Tom, asked me to come back a year later, and I did another play called Yellow Man. And then Tom asked me to come back for his opening season. So I think I just have like a special connection to here, but also as well, like I love the space. It's challenging, but in a way that I think forces you to be creative and is very much part of the, well, it almost feels like the other character in plays.
What are you guys up to next? I know that the play is going to go to, after you finish your run here, it's going to go to the Octagon Theatre in Bolton from the 24th of May to the 1st of June. Have you got anything coming up next that you want to talk about?
I just came off the back of a show in San Francisco called Big Data. So I sort of feel like I've slammed through two back-to-back rehearsal processes. Mm. So I'm quite excited to return to kind of just working on commissions and things that are coming up. I've got a new play and workshop at Playwrights Horizons in New York. So I'll be doing that. Both of us have small, tiny children. So there's also kind of juggling that at the moment. And you know, the sort of balance of, returning to work. As a parent.
Test Match is shown at the Orange Tree Theatre Richmond from April 24th to May the 18th, and then it will transfer to the Octagon Theatre Bolton from the 24th of May to the 1st of June. Thank you both so much for joining me, and good luck with the run.
Thank you.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny Off The Blocks.
Welcome to Jenny Off The Blocks, that time of the week where we sob into our scarves as we discuss all things women's sport. What a fantastic season Charlton Athletic women have had, alas. With one game to go this season, we trail Crystal Palace of all teams by 3 points. Crystal Palace face Sunderland in the final match of the season, who are third, and Charlton will face Southampton, who are fourth. So, we could still match Palace's 45 points, but lads, we are unlikely to score 22 goals, which is the number currently separating us on goal difference. So, with a heavy heart, congratulations, Crystal Palace. That's me spitting. And better luck next season, addicts. At least you've given me something to be hopeful for. While we're on the subject of football, let's talk about Queen's Park Ladies Under 12s. Now, I wouldn't normally cover Division 3 of the Bournemouth Youth Football League, but on this occasion I simply must because there are some new Invincibles in town. And they are the aforementioned Queen's Park Ladies Under 12s. They finished top of the league with 18 wins, 4 draws and 0 defeats. That's 58 points, 16 more than the second place team, which is a better than we're owned by the Royal Family of Qatar level of difference, in case you're not following the French League One, with 61 goals and they conceded just 11. And to boot, every pun intended, this is after overcoming resistance by the county's FA, who had initially told them to play in a girls' tournament. Their manager, Toby Green, who set up the team after his daughter told him she wanted to play, pushed back on this, knowing that they were good enough to take on the boys. He told Sky News, "The girls have done really, really well. They've worked so hard all season, not just in the games, but in their training as well. They've been really disciplined. They deserve it. I love this so much. Some more good news as we look forward to the Olympics in Paris this summer. Now, I think this may have been first reported a while ago, but it has only just been brought to my attention and I think it bears repeating. So this summer, there are set to be an unprecedented equal number of women competing at the Olympic Games in Paris, as there are men, a 50-50 split for the first time ever. This is up from 34% women participants in the Atlanta Games back in 1996 to 48% at the last Games in Tokyo. Or if you want to go even further back, there were just 22 women competitors at the Paris Games in 1900. That's just under 2.2% of the total number of athletes. It may interest you to note that at the Tokyo 2020 Games, which of course took place in 2021, Team GB actually sent slightly more women than men. 53.5% of the team were women. However, this is by no means the norm, and it is great to see the International Olympic Committee taking gender equality at the Games seriously, because the Olympics is a huge platform for women athletes who ordinarily struggle to make it onto the TV schedules, as you know, and because when they're shown at the same time as men, more people are watching. Hopefully this is something that will change, but you know, at the moment, it's definitely true. So this is great news and a good high to end on. Therefore, that is all from me this week, and I'll be back next time with more women's sport.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Mickey, which film that perpetuates the stupid idea that Tina Fey is not unbelievably attractive?
Right. Did we watch this week?
That's Tina Fey's thing, isn't it? Pretending that she's not unbelievably attractive.
Yeah.
The whole of Bossy Pants is just her going, what, little old ugly me? And you're like, mate, come on now.
Liz Lemon, beautiful.
It's her thing. It's weird. This week, we watched Tina Fey's teen classic, Mean Girls. I'm immediately going to clarify that is Tina Fey's 2004 Mean Girls, not Tina Fey's 2024 Mean Girls, the latter being a strange hybrid of the original film and the stage musical, which I watched for a full 7 minutes, confused as to how I'd forgotten all of the singing and the absence of Lindsay Lohan. That is my period brain for you. Maybe I'll return to the rest of Mean Girls 2024, not least because it does have John Hamm in it. But 2004's Mean Girls, directed by Mark Waters, written by Faye, and based on the 2002 self-help book Queen Bees and Wannabes by Rosalind Wiseman, was a total smash hit, grossing more than $130 million worldwide from a budget of around $17 million. Critics were mostly positive, praising the screenplay's smarts and humour and the performances, with Lohan singled out for particular plaudits. And indeed, she bagged a couple of gongs for her portrayal of Katie Heron, one from the Teen Choice Awards and the other from the MTV Movie Awards, who also gave an award to Rachel McAdams. But perhaps the greatest testament to Mean Girls' success is its place as a true pop culture phenomenon, with swathes of gifs, memes and quotes finding their way into all sorts of situations. Like what? Well, in August 2013, the White House tweeted a photo of President Obama's dog, Beau, holding a tennis ball and captioning, "Beau, stop trying to make fetch happen." Come on, that's cute. That is cute.
Yeah. I just realised how much stuff that's happened in the past I don't understand because I'd never seen Mean Girls, including one of those BAFTA speeches from last year, which you might be about to mention.
There was a BAFTA speech by Amy Lou Wood, I think, in which she basically tries to snap the award so she can share it. Yeah. I'm just going to go for the even wilder ones. In June 2018, the official Twitter account of the Israeli embassy in the US made headlines when it responded to a tweet by Iranian leader Ali Khamenei, calling Israel, quote, a malignant cancerous tumour, with an animated gif of the "why are you so obsessed with me" quotes. In March 2019, Hillary Clinton tweeted a gif of the same quote, which went viral for being considered a response to Donald Trump. It has truly infiltrated all walks of society. Hannah, you just mentioned this, but neither of you had actually seen it before, right?
No.
I'd seen bits of it, but never the whole thing.
I mean, I was obviously aware of it because "That's So Mean Girls" is ubiquitous as an expression. So I was aware of what the dynamic was in it. But no, I've never seen it. And actually, to be honest, never really wanted to see it either. I considered myself too old to watch this sort of thing when it came out. I'd have been like 30.
Yeah, I think that's key to why none of us had seen it the time it came out. We're all just that little bit old for a little bit. Who am I kidding? You and I are both way too old for when it came out, Hannah, and Jen gets with the little bit. She gets a little bit too old. But I was working at a theatre. I'm working with the youth theatre on something to do some PR, and they were talking a lot about Mean Girls, so that's when I watched it about 10, 11 years ago. That was my first introduction to Mean Girls. Let's talk a little bit about the plot. Actually, most of what it's about can be found in the full title of that self-help book, Queen Bees and Wannabes, Helping Your Daughter Survive Cliques, Gossip, Boyfriends and Other Realities of Adolescence. Or to keep it snappier, it's Cliques and Freaks, right?
Yeah.
Lindsay Lohan is Katie Herron, 16 years old and about to experience high school for the very first time. Up until now, thanks to her parents' work as anthropologists, she's been homeschooled while living in the little town of Africa. You know, Africa. Now need to be specific.
The whole way through.
The whole way through.
Wow.
Katie is quickly befriended by semi-goth Janice, that's Lizzie Kaplan, and her gay best mate Damien, that's Daniel Franzese, who will go on to have one of the weirdest scenes in the entire film. For now, they give Katie the lowdown on the school's hierarchy, with big focus on the plastics. The plastics. Wealthy but insecure Gretchen, nice but dim Karen, and Queen Bee / boss bitch Regina George, played by Rachel McAdams, who used to be Janice's best mate. Katie is keen to settle into her new school and join the mathletes, which might be social suicide, but is helmed by Tina Fey's very likeable Miss Norbury. However, when Regina asks Katie to sit with the plastics, Janice is all too keen to make it happen, getting Katie to spy on them, report back, and ultimately destroy the clique from within. Basically, by making Regina fat and ostracised. I said fat because that's what the plot deems Regina has become, but it is a big no from me. Is it a big no from you?
Yeah.
Good noises. Thank you very much. Anyway, as with a lot of undercover plans, Katie starts to turn, writing mean things in the burn book, obsessing over her looks, obsessing over Regina, and ultimately becoming the thing Janice hates. It all comes to a head when Regina works out what's going on, cannily puts herself in the burn book, releases the pages into the wild, and sends the school's female population into a massive tizzy / catfight. There's a big old assembly, Miss Norbury gives a barnstorming speech, a trust exercise starts well, then goes awry, and in a moment you may or may have not seen coming, Regina George gets hit by a bus. She's fine-ish. Yeah, you know.
She's all right. Back brace, but...
You know. She's all right, though, isn't she? Katie's popularity all but vanishes. She joins the mathletes, wins the competition for them, turns up late at the spring fling just in time to be crowned prom queen, shares her crown because awe, makes friends with everyone, and snogs Aaron. I wanted to start by asking a question not about the film, but about you two. I wondered, what were you like at school? Did you recognise the different cliques and if you sat in any of them?
No, when I was at school, I had a group of friends that was mixed boys and girls. I'd say they were all mostly lower middle class and I was working class. So none of us had shitloads of money or nice things particularly. And I would say my school was slightly different in that it was quite diverse. And so cliques tended to go more on ethnic backgrounds. So all the Italian kids mostly hung around together. Or because it was a Catholic school with quite a wide geography of drawing places, all of the kids who lived in one village or in a closer town tended to hang together.
Yeah, I mean, my school, not in any way remotely diverse. So, yeah, it was mostly working class kids and there weren't really any kind of ethnic minorities and there sure as fucking hell weren't any people who were willing to be openly gay or anything like that. So, there were loads of cliques, definitely. I straddled like a couple of different friendship groups. One was sort of like within my brother's friendship group. One was within a sort of like just normal, like we weren't super popular, we weren't unpopular, we were just very normal girls. But then I also was very good friends with like one of the hardest girls in the year who I'd like known forever, so no one would ever really give me any jip because no one wanted to incur the wrath of Rachel. So yeah.
I will add, though, that there was a group of girls who were kind of head being, but they were bitches, and I was friends with a few of them outside of that group, and actually, according to Facebook, they're all still friends and all hang out together. So, yeah, they don't seem to... They wouldn't say they were reflective of the plastics in that sense.
Yeah, I don't think the girls... I think, like, the sort of Queen Bee girls in my year at school were hard rather than super girly. Like, they were the girls that you didn't really want to fuck with.
Fair. Mick, what about you?
Oh, I mean, I was bullied by anyone who had a fucking voice box when I was at school, to be fair. Like, I think I was pretty smart and funny, and so the humour was very much used to get myself out of tricky situations. But both the Queen Bee kind of plastics, because it was definitely like the hot girls at my school sort of bullied me for not being very pretty and not being very slim. And then the hard girls bullied me because they liked beating people up, I guess, and I was quite an easy target. Yeah, and even my own friendship group bullied me. I didn't have a nice time, if I'm honest with you. So I didn't really fit in. I was sort of an outsider. But when I got to college, which I guess is when this is set, so at 16, I moved away from my school and just sort of reinvented myself, and then had a much nicer time and made friends with normal people and outsiders. I think that's where I sort of sat with the slightly more quirky. I'd have probably been drawn to your Janice initially. But that leads me on to the next question, because I wondered who you think in this film is the meanest mean girl.
I think Regina is. I mean, I think Janice is not like squeaky clean, like at all, because she encourages the whole fucking thing as an act of vengeance against Regina, obviously. So she's a mean girl. I think the film knows that she's a mean girl, but I think Regina is the most horrible.
Is it Regina's mum?
Oh, she's not horrible, she's just sad.
Is she the person who was her daughter and wants to make her daughter? She's a fascinating character, I would say, in this. And of course, obviously, love Amy Poehler. But
she's great in it as well. Yeah. She's so funny.
We were having a conversation the other day about a certain type of mother the other day, and yeah, she certainly fits into that ilk, I think. You know, stage mum, pushy mum, mum who lives vicariously through her
the
children.
The mum we meet at the end of Election as well, which yeah, was obviously last yeah. time's Adel dated. But yeah, Amy Poehler just nails that sort of, I just want to be a teenage
I am your
girl
friend.
Thing and just be, let's just be friends. I think Janice is the meanest girl. She totally manipulates Katie into being involved in something that she has no investment in, a beef that she has nothing to do with, wasn't around for. She creates a monster, in inverted commas, and she's the only person who doesn't get any comeuppance. And she's so mean to her best mate. She ridicules him the whole time.
Yeah. I really like him, but I think that's because I used to watch her... oh my God, what is it called? I think it's called Looking. I've told you to watch it before because it's got Murray Bartlett in it. And it's like Sex and the City or Girls, but set in San Francisco amongst gay men. And there's a character in it who's awful. And then he meets a character played by Daniel Franzese, who is so lovely that he actually turns this complete bell end into a nice man. So I feel quite fond of him. I carry that fondness over.
It's the opposite plots of Mean Girls, where she turns a quite nice girl into an absolute horror show.
Yeah.
I obviously knew that you guys hadn't seen it, but Hannah, I know that you're a huge 30 Rock fan. That came 2 years later, and I wondered, did any of the characters have echoes for you? Like, I think Jenna was probably a plastic when she was at school, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. And Karen, Amanda Siegfried, Karen is kind of Tracy Morgan in that she's, I mean, Tracy's obviously a lot more stupid, but that kind of hapless idiocy that gets her into, yeah. And also, of course, Tina Fey is playing another sort of Liz Lemon, as in a woman who feels that she's unsuccessful, even though she's apparently and seemingly very successful.
Yeah, it's so weird. What is going on with Tina Fey there?
I don't know. Has she got imposter syndrome or something?
Yeah, it's very strange. I did I was a little bit surprised that that hadn't made you curious to watch this, actually.
At this period, there was just some terrible, terrible teenage comedies about. So I think maybe I wrapped it up in that and just thought it was going to be She's All That or something like that.
Yeah, totally.
Even though it's written by Tina Fey. Yeah.
Okay, so a lot of the humour, I still laughed quite a lot. I think Tina Fey is a very funny woman. She's sort of proven that throughout her career. And it's so much wiser than teen movies. I feel like some people might have forgotten that. But, you know, as Hannah just hinted at, thanks to some of Jen's rated or dated picks, I have not. But they were the things that worked for me. And I wondered what, if anything, worked for you. Jen?
Yeah, I think it's funny. And, I mean, that's the whole point of it, isn't it? That it's supposed to be wiser. So, yeah, I think that worked for me. I think, you know, the final message of it is ultimately a good one. And, you know, the bit where she kind of, like, realises that, you know, doing a downer on other people won't actually make your life any better. It's all stuff that teenage girls should probably think about from time to time. But I don't know, like, the premise of it is a bit, I don't know. I feel like the premise of the whole thing is a bit shit on teenage girls, to be honest. But that's not the question you asked me, so I will limit myself now.
There were bits I laughed at, although I can't recall anything to mind right either. Now, so I don't think it was hilarious.
The one that made me laugh out loud was when he was like, the head teacher said, I will keep you here all night yes. if I have to. And the secretary yeah. said, we're not allowed to keep them past four. And he goes, I will keep you here till 4 p.m. Yeah. It's such yeah. a funny line. It really yeah. properly made me honk.
I think the sort of the relationship with the boy is really flat. And I'm also genuinely confused about what the message is about sexuality at that age, given that I was under the impression that Janice and Matey were both gay, and then they kiss at the end.
Like I said, they've got the weirdest scene in the film. I mean, yeah. this is very much not the answer to what worked for you, Hannah.
I mean, there are bits. I think, yeah, you're right. The message, that scene where Tina Fey gives them all a good talking to is good. But no, I didn't love it, I have to say.
Okay, what, if anything, didn't work for you?
We've already answered this.
What about Coach Carr messing with his students, just being played for laughs?
Yeah.
Just, you know, got yeah. a paedophile coach. Funny, isn't it?
That didn't register too much. Yeah, no, I know what you mean. I think the premise of it is a bit offensive to teenage girls, because teenage girls have this reputation. Hannah, you always talk about this, so you must have thoughts on this. Teenage girls have this reputation of just being like shit, basically. like they're all horrible to each other. And I think like what the film doesn't do particularly is explore the reasons why teenage girls maybe get into this slightly competitive state with one another.
Oh, I think it kind of does, in the sense that every time that you're at that house, the little girl is just watching this absolute stream of like yes. bullshit that's yeah. being fed to her. That I think you kind of, I think they try and explain why all of these three women in that family have ended up like they've ended up. You know, this is outside sort of pressure on them. Teenage girls are always seen as creating problems and not solving problems. And I think yeah. in my experience, teenage girls solve a lot of problems. I feel like in terms of datedness, I think it's interesting that I think the style of parenting that her parents have taken is so obviously unbelievably dated in the last 20 years. Like that their kid is basically having a horrible time at school and they are utterly unaware of it. It's just not something that would happen now. I think parents are much, much more, well, helicoptering, aren't they? They are much more evolved in the day-to-day.
Yeah, they're definitely not any better. They're very different, but not any better than Amy Poehler's mum.
Yeah.
I'd also suggest it's got some pretty broad strokes stereotyping in the cafeteria scene and throughout.
Yeah. The whole, like, referring to it as Africa throughout is weird, and it really jarred.
Yeah.
And then there's a bit at the end where Gretchen Mieners is, she's, like, friends with the cool Asian girls.
Yeah.
Who are one of the stereotyped cliques that you refer to. And uses the N-word in conversation with them. And yeah, no, I do think it is quite stereotyped. But then the whole thing's quite stereotyped, isn't it? Like the the clique of mean girls are a stereotype.
I mean, I think the stereotype is kind of the point. It's a comedy.
And I think we're supposed to be seeing it through a white teenage girl lens. Mm. I think that's also the point. But it's very Y2K. There's so many films we watch from around this time that use the R word. And this film is one of those films that uses the R word a couple of times. And that is just very, very dated. But I don't know whether it works in getting... I don't know that it gets away with it, is what I'm trying to say. These really broad brushstrokes. So the wannabes in the cafeteria scene are all what would be deemed overweight or disabled. And that seems a little bit or quite a lot icky.
I mean, you have mentioned the weight issue, but yeah, that's all a bit ridiculous. I mean, I actually think sometimes accusations of fat phobia go a bit far. And I say that as someone who has been medically ordered to lose some weight. But I do think portraying someone who has gone up a dress size as now being fat it's a shit message to send out to teenage girls.
It is. It definitely is. And the thing about Regina where she's like making her eat those sort of like bodybuilding bars or whatever
protein
they are.
Bars. Nom nom nom.
It's like ridiculous. But what I would say, and you know, here's dated for you basically, but what I would say is that it's very of its time. Then particularly, I would say, being very thin, we're just coming out of the 90s, that was very, very fashionable at the time. And girls, you know, they did wear those sort of, you can almost see your pubes, kind of low slung jeans and like just skimpy as fuck everything, basically. So I think that like it's of its time, but I think it is reflective of the time for sure.
Yeah, I agree with you.
I hope it would be a bit different now. I don't know for sure that it would be, but I would hope that that wouldn't be a message in a film for teenage girls now.
The other thing, and Hannah, you touched on this, is I'm like, why is Janice not a lesbian? Why can't she be a lesbian?
Well, I mean, she kind of suggests that she is at one point when she talks about having a crush on her.
I thought she was joking.
She's joking.
Is she joking?
I think she is.
Well, yeah, then she ends up with Kevin G, who I don't have time to discuss, to be honest with you. Leader of the
Yeah, Mathletes. She does at the end. She's with him, isn't she?
She's dating him, yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. Why can't she be gay? Yeah. But then I suppose the other alternative sort of way of looking at that is that the misfit is presented as gay.
Oh, yeah. And also, yeah, you are absolutely correct in the sense that I don't want people to think that I'm saying, yeah, just because... Because you could, even if she wasn't joking about having a crush on a woman, you can have a crush on a woman and still not be a lesbian. So obviously,
Jen
this
Brister.
Is complicated waters. I mean,
very
there
much
we go.
Is gay, but we all fancy her, is what I mean.
Yeah,
and by we all, we mean everyone in the world.
Yeah,
everyone in the world.
But yeah, in the updated version in Mean Girls 2024, I mean, I didn't get this in the first 7 minutes, but I read the plot pressy, and they've updated it so that Janice is a lesbian. Oh, they're queer, both. Regina and Janice are queer characters.
I do wonder how now...
Brown cow.
Sorry. In 2024, whether the quick brown fox jumps over. No, I do wonder whether the queen bees, the women, that group is still that group, or whether change... You know, geeks are cool now. Kids are out much more. So being gay is no longer a bar to being cool. I do wonder whether or not it's also a past world now, whether young people watching it now, what they would make of it, whether they would still recognise. Because I think, interestingly, I think the concept still exists amongst millennials. You just look and see how American journalists interact with each other online and you're like, wow, that is Mean Girls. That is properly still cliquey shit exists. But for millennials who this film was for, essentially. I wonder what young people or younger people, Generation Z, would make of Mean Girls, whether they would recognise the dynamic.
I think that's a really interesting and acute observation. And I think they also realise that with the reboot because it is Builders, Not Your Mother's Mean Girls.
Right. Oh, interesting. Yeah.
On that note, Mean Girls 2004, rated or dated?
I think it is dated. In a few ways, yeah, I do think it's a bit dated, but I also think that in some respects it's kind of like, well, I don't know, because we obviously none of us are Gen Z, so we can't answer Hannah's question, which would prove this point one way or the other, wouldn't it? But
genius facts for employing a 17-year-old.
Thank you. I think probably parts of it are kind of timeless in a way. And I do think it's quite an enjoyable watch. So I'm going to say, although I think it is a bit dated, I'm going to say it's rated.
Interesting. Hannah?
I didn't hate it, but I didn't recall that much about it when I actually had to sit down and record this. So I think ultimately it's a bit, it's probably dated for a couple of the reasons that we said. I don't know if it's still reflective of the way that young people interact with each other. I think there are some issues around sexuality and that whole Africa thing and some of the language, which means that, yeah, I would probably fall closer to dated.
I think it's dated in the ways we've discussed, but it's also like a really accurate snapshot of that time of what of like Y2K. I am so hip, guys. Y4K. I'm so futuristic of Y2K, and I think it stands up, and I did enjoy watching it. And I think there must be something in it, otherwise they wouldn't have updated it. And I think that update makes it both dated and rated.
Yeah, interesting.
What are we watching next time? Because it isn't next week, it's next time.
Next time, we will be watching 1999's East is East.
Lovely stuff. Or is it? Tune in.
So.
Standard issue for all women.